It's bust off time. Welcome back to Canuck is a Slur, a free-flowing podcast that sometimes touches on Canadian subjects. I am Kelly, and with me on the sidelines, all tangled up in the ropes, is Tanner from Beyond the Breakers, a podcast that you'd have to assume is probably about sports history or something related to this series.
Beyond the Busters, we could call it.
Oh, is it too late for a rebrand? Because that's pretty good.
Well, I mean, we're probably about that time where, like, you know, we could kind of just say, hey, we're going to take the pod a different direction. It's been 5 good years. I think we've probably covered all the shipwrecks by now.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we could probably just do something new.
Yeah. Well, they just ran out of space at the bottom of the ocean floor. So, like, there's nowhere else to put a ship. So, problem solved.
Yeah. And I mean, and honestly, most of them aren't that interesting. So, yeah.
No, I've been meaning to tell you this. I really hate shipwrecks. They're so fucking boring. Oh, wow. It's at the bottom of the lakes again. Yeah.
There's like 10 good ones. Oh, the ship disappeared. I wonder where it went. Huh.
Yeah, well, it probably went up. I'm sure this time it went up into space. Come on.
It ascended into heaven like the prophet Elijah. Okay.
So, yeah, on that, do you want to plug your excellent podcast? I don't know. So, what is the diminishing returns you think of, like, plugging the podcast at the beginning of every episode of a series? Like, I feel like people are, they're in or they're out by part three, no? Or do you just really have to beat everyone over the head with it? I don't know how this works.
No, I like it, especially ours, because we have such a fixed, rigid, like, Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. Kind of like one of the TV lawyers. Like, I just want to say that over and over and over again, just so it's stuck in people's head.
Yeah, it is nice to have a podcast with a straightforward premise that you can be like, this is what it's about. And like, oh, perfect.
Mm-hmm.
That answers all my questions about what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
What happens with me when I'm having a conversation with someone and they'll be like, oh, what's this, you know, stuff you have in a bag? I'm like, well, this is my audio equipment for recording my podcast. So they're like, oh, you have a podcast. What's it about? And I say, well, it's about Canadian culture and history, but like, it's not boring. I promise you it's not boring. I do not want to talk about boring shit. So you're always off to a great start.
That's why when I introduce mine, and I think I did it on one of the two episodes previously of this, is that I always chase it with, it's not an overly technical podcast, like as a way to cover, like, we don't actually know that much about what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's good to keep expectations limited sometimes.
Absolutely. I am trying to avoid being technical. I think this is going to be the part of the series that is going to, it's in danger of being the most testicle. Oh my God.
Yes, probably that too.
Well, with where some of the boots are flying. And yeah, on the subject of being technical, this is the part of the series that there's not quite a way of going around it. It is going to be the most information dense, but I have done my best to condense quite a few sources into one distilled narrative. All right, so before we get into the subject today, we have a few patrons to thank. I know the classic industry-wide advice is always thank your new patrons in part three, which I know is maybe something that doesn't come up for you a lot as someone who doesn't always have a part three. This is why it's very fortunate that three seems to be becoming our minimum for number of parts.
I have that issue with bonus episodes mostly. They just tend to sprawl and expand. What I originally thought would be one bonus episode about the naval battles off of Guadalcanal is now going to be four.
Mm-hmm. So in a very timely manner, at the beginning of part three here, we are going to remember to thank the patrons who have joined since our last patron shout out at the beginning of our Sean Avery series. So at the very generous good old Kingston boy level, is McLean. Thank you for joining at the bespoke art tier. And interestingly, what has happened is the people who have joined at this tier have not been making me do all the drawings that I owe them, which I guess is appreciated.
Do you think they're waiting to cash them all in at the same time? Like a run on the banks type situation?
Yeah, I think what happens is you end up, like, nobody has use for one piece of commissioned art. But if you wait until December, you can be like, hey, can I cash in the last 12? I really need to make a last minute wall calendar for my brother. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like I'm going to get fucked on that.
I'm in a new place. I need to redecorate a bit. And I'm going to need some of those arts here.
Now, the opposite of generous, we have an absolute cheapskate at the good old Canadian boy level. I won't give out the real name, but it was the pseudonymous Mao from our one of our recent bonus episodes. He's joining the legion of people who have been guests on this show and who I consequently have given the no strings attached Patreon feed to, who has been kind enough to support me financially anyway. So thanks for that, even though I still am contractually required to call you a cheapskate at this tier. And then we have three new good old Ontario boys, you know, not showing off, not falling behind. We have H, and we have one who is canceled, so scratch that. And then we have Malta. So thank you to H and Malta for joining at that level.
You're not going to have a patrons we lost in memoriam segment on every episode?
I need to finish writing the screeds about each and every last one of them. So
we could probably do that with the way that our patrons work is, you know, we'll get a gaggle of them, and then, you know, we'll have two or three people cancel. So we could probably do that every episode of like, here's all the patrons we lost this week.
Well, RIP to all of the patrons, including the haters and losers, but let's get into part three here. This is a part of the series where there is a simple version of the story, and the simple version is it's complicated. We're basically going to talk about how we got two fundamentally competing football codes that emerged. Yeah, there's no getting around it. This is going to be our most information-dense one, but I have tried to kind of keep it to what are the most interesting bullet points of how this goes down. And the reason I think it's interesting to get into is because all of the process that we're going to see really show up mirrored in Canada, in the United States, everywhere else the game spreads. Before we get into the meat of it, I'm just going to catch us up to speed. In part two, we saw a series of semi-formalized kicking games at a few English schools that were variously called football. During the recording, I threw in an ad-libbed explanation to stress that these were quite different from the medieval mob football games that we briefly touched on in part one. The reason I felt the need to explain this is that it's easy to see these 16th century references to football and picture some kind of activity that was, you know, foundationally on some level about kicking a ball. But from what we know of that period, these were more of group wrestling activities with, you know, few, if any, rules. And I realized as we were recording, well, okay, we hadn't really filled in the gap of how we got to punting heavy games from those chaotic melee games, or even why this name football stuck before the emphasis on outright kicking the ball was even there. Mm. And I kind of felt like, oh, that was a bit of an oversight in my part. I must have just gotten too excited about filling in, you know, all the shit about people being killed by tennis balls. Mm-hmm. So after we recorded those episodes, I went back in the source material and I looked around online for information to kind of like, okay, I need to backfill this hole a little bit. We just need like a tight, tidy answer of why did this change? And the thing is, it's kind of not there in the sources either. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that there is a better answer other than it's complicated and the evidence is spotty. We can fill in a little with some cautious speculation. The structural incentives of playing in an open field with dozens of teenagers rather than, you know, in a street or a village green with hundreds of adults, it would seem to be, you know, it's a natural influence towards slightly more technical, tactical play, right? Not a lot more, but a little more. Mm-hmm. Now, even on this vector, there's a useful critique in one of this episode's sources, and that's writer Adrian Harvey's Football: The First 100 Years. It characterizes this depiction of, you know, a refined, sophisticated sport is developed in the public schools while the common people were engaging in barbaric activities down there in the mud. You know, he criticizes this as being pretty simplistic, right? Oversimplified narratives are going to they're going to continue to be a huge theme. And he points out that this narrative was kind of pushed by 19th century writers who, they happen to be alumni of these schools that they're talking about. Right. And what's more, like, it's a depiction that serves the narrative of codified sport as some kind of noble civilizing process, right? Mm-hmm. It is very convenient to say like, oh yeah, basically fancy boys who, you know, that whole quote about like Waterloo being won in the fields of Eton is very like, we are the special enlightened few who came and invented these real civilized games, and all of like the dirt farmers, you know, have no relevance from this point on. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of important to keep in mind as we get into the colonies, the idea of sport as like a civilizing process, right?
Right.
For now, I just want to kind of leave it with this caveat. Harvey does provide in his book evidence that the games were also developing outside of the education centers, and we don't actually have particular reason to believe that these different segments of society were not still influencing each other's activities. Mm-hmm. Cross-pollination happens everywhere we look at these sports, right? So there's no reason to believe that what was happening in those public schools existed in a vacuum from what was still happening in the villages. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Reminds me a bit of some of the cross-pollination between the NFL and some of the occasional other alternate leagues that crop up, you know, your USFLs, your AFLs, your XFLs, and how occasionally one of those leagues, just to get people watching it, will come up with some quirky rule change. And sometimes the NFL sees that and says, hey, maybe we could use that too. Even though these are the dirty peasants wrestling in the mud, we still kind of like this thing that they're doing. So we're gonna add that to our game too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as a supplement to this, you know, it's not stuff we're going to talk about, in part because it's been covered so well by, I assume you're familiar with like the work of John Boyce, right?
I don't think so.
Oh my God, you would love John Boyce. So he...
Is this a blind spot for me?
Yeah. So are you familiar with...
John Boyce.
Are you familiar with Scoregami?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's the guy who came up with Scoregami.
Oh, okay. The concept of like a unique score in a football game.
Yeah. So they put out a series of like telling the history of the NFL through the history of Scoregami and how it was changed by, for example, exactly like you said, the AFL coming up with a 2-point conversion and that getting integrated into the NFL. I think that was one of them.
Okay. I just Googled this person and I think the problem is that I always assumed this person's name was pronounced John Bois.
Right? So. Oh my God, it's so fucking annoying as somebody who speaks French. I
do know who you're talking about, yes.
Yes, I was always saying John Bois.
I think I follow them on Twitter.
Yeah, in my head. And then I'm like, why is everyone saying Boyce? And I think he says it himself at one point, and I'm like, man, English speakers were a mistake.
I was thinking some like 1700s English writer like spelled Boyce or something. I was like, no, I've never heard of this person.
Oh, that's really funny.
Okay. So I do know who we're talking about.
Yeah, John Bois / John Boyce. I truly was like, oh, as I'm covering like history of football stuff, I should make sure I'm not overlapping someone who's like clearly done it better. But yeah, check out the Scoregami series. It is so good at like showing you, even if you don't care about gridiron football, why it's like such a quirky and interesting game and mm-hmm. creates these like weird little pockets of, yeah, digestible narrative.
Yeah, like I'll see the updates on Twitter. People will be sharing like, oh, this game today was Scoregami because the Browns lost to the Bengals 45-41. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Now, for the name part, I do have a hypothesis on this. One of the threads I looked at more closely, you know, between this recording gap, between part two and part three, was that term handball. You might recall we saw it mentioned way back in the 14th century, at least alongside football. But by Joseph Strutt's time, when he was writing that book in 1801, for him, handball was barely worth mentioning. I think part of it is that, at least from my readings, handball has so much overlap with this whole constellation of games, right? With courts, walls, and then later rackets. It's like tennis, fives. They all have their own specific names. Hmm. Or what people were calling handball had more of a likelihood to overlap with like these hurling games in that Cornish sense, right? And those have overlap with the football games.
You know, I had almost managed to forget about the Cornish games, and here you go reminding me all about it.
Yeah,
you think you're done with the Cornish, and here they come. I don't know if we pointed this out in part one or two, but Joey Strutts is an amazing like runway name.
Oh, like a fashion runway.
Yes.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Yes, Joey Strutts. I think that would work.
Oh, he was born too soon for his calling. What sticks out, though, about this, you know, this first set of sports, right, these kind of hand games that often become paddle games, wall games, is generally...
I've known a few hand games to become paddle games myself, so...
See, and I thought I was done with the double entendres, but I guess not. those always pull me back in. Yeah, these games, they generally tend to forbid the use of the feet, at least at, like the way we play them today, right? So it could be that football emerged as a term not to encompass games that forbid the hands, as you know the association purists like to think of it today, or even that required kicking, but rather it's like these are the games that allow you to kick the ball at all.
Okay. Interesting.
Again, this is a hypothesis that I've kind of formulated from poring over this stuff for so many weeks now. But like it's worth remembering that this is. Arguably, this is the singular thing that unites every conceivable football code. You are allowed to kick the ball at any time, as far as I know. I think you can, right? Like in the NFL and stuff. Like you can, if you're just downfield, you can punt the ball away if you really wanted to.
I don't think there's technically anything that would prohibit it.
Exactly.
I mean, there is an infraction for like illegal kicking. If you're trying to kick a ball, like a live ball on the ground forward, maybe it would fall under that. But I mean, yeah, because teams will do like, you know, they'll have if they're kind of like in that medial area where you're not sure if you want to go for it or punt, they'll snap it to the quarterback and he'll do like just a little like pooch punt where he'll just drop it and kick it downfield. He's not the punter, but he's still punting the ball. So I guess, yeah, that would fall under that.
For the purposes of my theory, it's much easier to say that you're basically allowed to kick the ball in every game. So
I guess my question would be, I don't know handball well enough. If the ball gets kicked in handball, is it like immediately a dead ball like in basketball?
I looked this up. In the modern day game of handball, you are not allowed to kick the ball.
Okay.
Now, obviously, like what we call handball in the modern day is actually like I think it's much newer as a code. I don't think there's a lot more like direct lineage for it. But anyway, that's pretty tangential. I also have a suspicion that like it's possible this term is kind of connected to the ball itself primarily as opposed to kind of these higher order ideas of gameplay. Because balls for cricket, tennis, golf, things like that, they're generally, and they've always been on that small and compact side of things. Mm-hmm. And a football, from anything I've seen, has always been a much larger object that you can really put your foot into. Even in practice, if you're actually just wrestling for it, it's like, yeah, we're wrestling, but we're wrestling with a football. Like, this is what the ball is. This is what I made this out of, a pig's bladder and some cowhide.
Mm-hmm. Football coming from the original, much longer name of you can put your foot into this ball.
That's kind of my theory, but we'll flesh this out more and we'll circle back to these questions. Now, getting back to our public school games, we looked at some of the differentiation that was going on in some of, you know, these little kickabout activities. And a recurring theme when you read about any one of these institutionally specific sports is people are going to describe them as something like, well, it's a cross between association football and rugby football. And for reasons that I hope we've kind of made clear to this point, that's really misleading framing. All of these are just, they're branches coming off of the same big chaotic tree, right? We talked about three other schools in the previous episode. We talked about Eton, Harrow, and Winchester. Today, we're going to talk a little more about the school rugby. And to understand how the game at rugby evolved compared to these other ones, we have to attack a foundational myth, which, as we covered at the very beginning of part one, that's the sort of thing you're quite familiar with as a baseball fan, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, that one big obstacle that is just the easiest one to repeat, like Abner Doubleday inventing baseball. And then it gets repeated so easily that that becomes sort of the dominant narrative when there's less than zero evidence that this happened.
Right. Okay. So keep all that in mind. So the story that we have to look at today is, it's one that I actually remember being taught myself when I was a kid and I was learning to play rugby or rugby union specifically. Mm. It's best expressed by this commemorative plaque that is still mounted at that school to this very day. Do you want to read this for us?
This stone commemorates the exploit of William Webb Ellis, who, with a fine disregard for the rules of football as played in his time, first took the ball in his arms and ran with it, thus originating the distinctive feature of the rugby game, AD 1823.
Right, so that's a neat and tidy little story, right? Should be your first indication that's not really true.
Because it just sounds like that would just be like, okay, you can't do that. put the ball down.
Well, it's not quite that. This story, this narrative, is deeply ingrained into the culture of the game itself, to the extent the physical actual trophy that countries compete for in the World Cup every 4 years, it's called the Webb Ellis Cup. It's named for Mr. Webb Ellis. Now, William Webb Ellis was a real person. He did attend the school and he did play there. And a lot of people even made the occasion of celebrating the supposed bicentennial of rugby football in 2023. In the thesis that we read from at the end of the previous episode, Graham Curry comprehensively attacks this myth. The whole section is a great read, but in the interest of brevity, I've taken his main points along with some of Adrian Harvey's and a few other sources to give you a concise summary of this misconception. So first off, all of these schools were playing kicking games that contained differing rules on handling and catching, including ones we haven't talked about. Charterhouse School, for example, is also attested to have allowed, quote, a considerable amount of handling in the 1820s. All of these games were evolving and iterating continuously over the years. A rugby school had a long-standing process wherein players would gather post-match and debate rules and the validity of actions, including bendings of the rules or outright violations of the rules that had happened on that day.
Hmm.
So you play a game and you have a lot of loosey-goosiness in the rules, and then you sit down after and go like, okay, well, how did we feel about that?
Like a struggle session.
Kind of, yeah.
For rugby. for football, whatever they're calling this game.
Yeah, they're very much just calling it football at this point, right? Because it's just, this is football and this is how we're playing it, and we're continuously iterating the rules. And so multiple individuals have been variously credited with contributing to the evolution of the carrying rules. And finally, this is maybe the big one, the singular source of the anecdote about William Webb Ellis did not emerge until the late 1870s and is marked by inconsistency. And this is how it's described by Adrian Harvey. Now, I have little square brackets because I've corrected what Harvey wrote, which is to call him Ellis. It is a barreled surname, right? It's like David Lloyd George or Sacha Baron Cohen. It is a like two named last name, just without a hyphen, but his last name was Webb Ellis.
Okay. Matthew Bloxham's original account in 1876 claimed that Webb Ellis performed the feat in 1824. When Bloxham rewrote his account in 1880, he changed this date to 1823 for the very good reason that Webb Ellis had left rugby school by 1824.
Not off to a great start.
No, and similar to the Doubleday myth in that any analysis of it very quickly is like, okay, Doubleday would have been like 20 when this happened, and he would have been on his deployment in like Kansas. So no, that kind of isn't great evidence for this.
Yeah, so on the exact same note, Matthew Bloxham, the only source of the anecdote, he had finished at rugby himself back in 1820. So 3 years before this was supposed to have happened. 3 or 4 years, depending which version of his story. And to flesh out the timeline further, the plaque you read from, it was not put up until 1900 based on an investigation begun 5 years earlier by a group called the Old Rugbyan Committee, and which had themselves admitted they had zero firsthand evidence of the story. So I think that was something you brought up with the baseball myth, right? Like it was basically come up with by a committee who was tasked with essentially investigating their own origins.
Yeah, I mean, it was a pervasive myth already. And then sort of baseball bigwigs come together and establish, okay, we need a central narrative for the game if we're going to establish this as, you know, as a regulated national sport. And let's go with this one. This is the easiest thing, rather than having to do exactly what you're doing right now, which is to go back and read lots of stuff from hundreds of years ago. So they're like, yeah, Doubleday, that's good enough for everyone. There's no internet yet, so no one can really check this. So Right. Yeah, why not?
Yeah, it's a good point. Like, as this is what I've learned from trying to just write a factual, coherent account, is that the truth is infuriatingly complicated.
Yeah, and I think that's with like any of these myths, the comfort of having someone on one afternoon sit down and write a rule book for this game is very helpful in sort of like, I don't know, in a sense, validating it maybe as, okay, this is a real game. This is not just some thing that someone came up with, you know, at random. This has rules. This has structure.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe that's the comfort of it.
I would call it almost a low stakes great man theory.
An all right man theory of history.
Yeah. History surely has to be made by very singular individuals and not, you know, collaboration. William Webb Ellis himself, he was dead by then, which presumably made him difficult to reach for comment, right? In fact, he died in southern France back in 1872 in relative obscurity. Now, this is interesting to me. There's a reason we now know where his grave even is, and you can make a pilgrimage to it, and many fans do. This was due to the efforts of a former player and local journalist. Now, since this guy was French, I think his name is pronounced Roger, maybe Dries. It looks like Roger Dries, D-R-I-E-S. And this journalist, he was working to find William Webb Ellis's grave. He was collaborating with someone who is apparently a recurring character on this podcast. So can you guess who this was? This is a cross-series recurring character who is not George Strombolopoulos and not Don Cherry.
Oh, no.
Nothing to do with hockey.
And this is a French person?
The former rugby player and local journalist is named Roger Dries. Mm-hmm. And he collaborates with a recurring character from our podcast to find William Webb Ellis's grave.
And what year is this, roughly?
I think in the 50s.
I don't know. Is it Maurice Richard?
It is none other than noted aerophobe Ross McWhorter, friend of the pod and friend of the provisional IRA back in 1958. He keeps coming back.
Amazing.
Somehow Ross McWhorter returned. Just a tremendous little bit of trivia. Like, yeah, why not? Why not? Just he's the Forrest Gump of weird athletic obscura.
So next time someone asks you what your podcast is about, you're just like, do you know Ross McWhorter?
Yeah. The reason that this whole WebLS myth took hold so easily, quite possibly, is that in the same year the committee began their investigation, which was 1895, another great schism was occurring, and that being the splitting off of 22 teams from the Rugby Football Union to form an organization that would later grow into the profoundly depraved football code for perverts known as Rugby League.
So I was going to ask, so like, is Rugby Union the more popular? Like, if someone is just talking about rugby with no qualifiers, are they probably talking about Rugby Union, or is that...
Yes, unless they are Australian.
Okay. That's fucked up, because they already have their Australian rules football. I don't know why they need another one.
Rugby League is popular in Australia and Northern England, and that's basically it.
Okay.
We'll briefly touch on it later.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so this is a big schism that's happening. It's like, yeah, Rugby Union is essentially the sport that we have been talking about to a much greater extent when we talk about rugby football.
Mm-hmm.
The Rugby Football Union forms in 1871, and in 1895, they have a huge schism over essentially professionals versus amateurs. Again, we'll cover it later.
Mm.
And then these people split off to form what's called the Northern Rugby Football Union, and that becomes like Rugby League.
The Provisional Rugby Union.
Yes. Yeah, 100%. So now, yeah, Rugby Union is the clear global winner in terms of a popularity contest. But at the time, like, it's a huge threat mm-hmm. to your stability to have all these defectors. So you can kind of see at that time, these old rugbyans, they really want to establish this idea of essentially a clear, pure lane lineage to kind of salvage their pride, right? And be like, well, we have the history and the story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That same sense of pride has also been employed to contend as to why rugby began to develop such an especially distinctive playing style to begin with. And they did, by the early 19th century, make Graham Curry's list of the most prestigious schools that we read at the end of part two. And while they weren't technically the newest school by date of establishment, apparently they were kind of latecomers when it came to that echelon of status. And one of Curry's major sources, Barbarians, Gentlemen, and Players, subtitled A Sociological Study of the Development of Rugby Football, it's from 1979, explains it this way.
At the beginning of the 19th century, rugby occupied a low position in the rank order of public schools. Even as late as about 1850, i.e., at a time when the school had begun to acquire a national reputation, the captain of cricket wrote to his Eton counterpart requesting a match. He's said to have received as his reply, "Rugby, rugby, well, we'll think about it. If you can tell me where it is..." Damn.
Yeah, so that's really going to set the tone. It's really good to remember that all of these schools, as I tried to, you know, drive the point home in the previous episode, they're all just the most insufferable fucking pricks. And it wasn't just Eton looking down on them. So Harrow Boys were also said to have left rugby off of their 5-member list of real public schools in the 1840s. And not even everyone on that list had always been on it. Westminster declined a cricket match against the lowly private school. That is the actual words they use when they're talking down to them. When they're talking down to Charterhouse in 1818. So it's the exact same, like, word for word thing where they're like, no, we're a public school. We don't compete against a private school. So they refused a cricket match. So of those 7 places that are named by Curry, only one seems to have gotten it worse than rugby. As late as 1866, the Westminster football captain declined a challenge from his equivalent at Shrewsbury, informing him that his little shithole of an education center was not one recognized by something called the Public Schools Club. Did not really look into what that is.
So this is Shrewsbury that's being shat upon here?
Yeah, at this later stage. So like the timeline is basically... Okay. In 1818, it's like, well, there's only 4 public schools, not you, Charterhouse. And then in 1850, it's like, okay, there's 5 public schools, but not you, Rugby. And then in 1866, like, okay, there's 6 public schools, but not you, Shrewsbury. And it kind of, like, the list keeps growing. Mm. I don't know the exact number now. I think it's a little, like, it's a little messier because there's not this, I don't think there's this self-selecting list of more prestigious schools anymore. You just have... Mm-hmm. public schools, and they're all expensive and fancy, but I think everyone kind of still knows what the, like, you know, Eton is still up there for one of the most prestigious.
I'm glad I know something else about Shrewsbury now. Previously, I really only knew the Battle of Shrewsbury.
Oh.
But now I know that they have a dog shit school.
Yeah.
So that's that's something else I know about them.
Yeah, they're merely the seventh most prestigious school in the entire United Kingdom.
I mean, is that even worth it? I mean, yeah. Do they even know? Have they even heard about math yet over there?
Oh my God. Okay, this is a digression, but you know, I don't know if you had this experience. Like, did you read Harry Potter when you were growing up?
I read the first one, but by that point I was already hooked with Lord of the Rings. So like Harry Potter didn't do anything for me because I had just finished reading the Lord of the Rings. I would still stand by that.
No, for sure. But I read it as when I was pretty young, like when it was fairly new. And I remember as a North American child reading about this very fantastical school where they have all these like houses and dress robes and have head boys and like all this, these weird, incredibly esoteric things. And I'm like, haha, wizard school. But so much of it was literally just how British just public schools were. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember learning that about like, oh, like that the house prefect. And it's like, oh, that sounds like that's such a cool fantasy concept.
Yeah.
No, that's just school. Like the magic is the only thing that's not accurate.
Right. Like, so one of the things that really bugged me as a kid is when you read it as a kid and you're like, why are these people always going to like divination and potions classes and they never go to math class or English class? So we're going to come up to this later, but one of the issues that comes up in these schools later is like, hey, why are you mostly teaching kids classics and divinity and you're not teaching them math? So again, surprisingly accurate portrayals in Harry Potter.
I mean, there's always the pendulum swing from the humanities to the hard sciences and then back. So this is, I mean, that's pretty normal, I'd say.
Yeah. There is a Harry Potter STEM school. She didn't write about it. They barely use magic.
I don't want to know what kind of science they'd be learning at J.K. Rowling's STEM school.
Oh my God. The insane wizard phrenology that they're doing there is like almost too upsetting to even reprint. If you put the calipers on the Hufflepuff skull.
It's like, yeah, the sorting hat had a much, much darker origin story.
At the STEM school, they just have a straight up eugenics hat. They're like, it's the eugenics hat. If it calls your name to this side, you get to go into the nice chambers. If it calls your name onto this side, you get sterilized. Huzzah.
The number of times, and you can bleep this if you need to, the number of times the word "void" would get used is probably, like unprintable.
That's actually what Muggle is short for.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
It's been there all along.
All right. So, the core idea here is you have this like very snooty inter-school social dynamic, right? As the argument goes, that very dynamic is what contributes to driving rugby school to develop an especially unique game on purpose, basically.
Hmm.
So chief among the standout features at the time it was emerging would have been, so the focus on running with the ball is a big one. The oval shape of the ball itself, which this is older than I thought. It dates back at least as far as 1851. And you have the H-shaped goalpost, which emphasized the kicking of a goal over a crossbar as opposed to just between the posts at all. Or sometimes, depending on what game we're talking about, under a certain height. Like, even they wouldn't necessarily have crossbars to kick under, just like, well, it has to be kicked under the height of the goalposts and shit like that.
Mm-hmm.
These traits, they're not going to remain confined to, you know, just each individual schoolyard. Cross-pollination is going to continue as it tended to do and tends to do. For just one example, the then quite new Marlborough School officially adopted rugby's rules in 1852. Another example of the changing landscape of these public schools. This school is not making anyone's, you know, most prestigious school list when it's founded. I think they were founded in 1843, so it's very, very new on the block compared to these other ones.
Mm-hmm.
Now, today, Marlborough is ranked among, like, the wider list of fancy boys schools.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was recently, like, crushing it on some, like, international private school list. I have to performatively say that I hate to add another digression to such a big episode, but I did my little bit of diligence. I'm on the Wikipedia page for Marlborough School. And their list of alumni is just a hell of a thing to stumble across at 1 a.m. Now, bear with me here because this is going somewhere. So this is just Wikipedia voice, right?
Mm-hmm.
Former pupils include the Nobel laureate Sir Peter Medawar, poet laureate Sir John Betjeman, wartime poet Siegfried Sassoon, art historian and Soviet spy Anthony Blunt, writer Dick Kingsmith, impossible not to say Dickie, journalist Frank Gardner, James Mates, Tom Newton Dunn, and Hugh Pym. Are you bored yet? Businessman Simon Woodruff, comedian Jack Whitehall, singers Nick Drake and Krista Berg, DJ and producer Frederick Gibson, known as Fred again, physician and broadcaster Phil Hammond, fashion moguls Amanda Harleck and Stella Tennant, and convicted human trafficker Ghislaine Maxwell.
All right.
Oh, I don't know if you had to keep that on.
Gotta learn it somewhere.
If we're like, I want to pull some Wikipedia editors aside and just be like, it doesn't have to be comprehensive.
Yeah, like who's going to be reading? It's like, hey, they left Ghislaine off of here, I think.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't check the talk page. There might be a massive edit war over this. I should have looked.
There was one other name early in the list that I was going to comment on, and I forget who it was. I don't know.
Was it Krista Berg, singer of Lady in Red?
It was definitely not that. I think maybe it was just the name of the school, the Marlboro. Mm. So, like, when did they get around to making the cigarettes?
You know, I was looking for the cigarette guy in this list. I didn't see it, but...
I don't know if you read this deeply on the history of it, but is this school named for or founded by, like, the Duke of Marlboro, like, the famous one? Is it spelled like the cigarettes, or is it spelled with, like, a G-H at the end?
It's spelled with a G-H. I'm assuming this one is just based on, like, the county or whatever, so...
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Not super relevant. I was just like, I was forced to read this list, and now everyone has to listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
But hey, they got Kate Middleton, too. That's fun. And, like, I checked my high school's Wikipedia page. It doesn't list the triple murder, so it is possible to make editorial choices. But let's go back to our status rivalry. We get a sense of just how these Eden boys were handling the trends that we're talking about based on their 1849 rules, and with them being, as we learned earlier, the second school to ever issue a set of rules after rugby. While the scoring of Eton's rouges behind the goal line wasn't specific as to how you touched the ball 2 years earlier, suddenly the laws of the game explicitly said, quote, the ball may not be caught, carried, thrown, nor struck by the hand, end quote. Between that and the condition that the ball could not be kicked above the 7-foot goalposts, as a carryover from their earlier rules, The authors of this 1979 rugby history that I just had you read from hypothesized the following.
Given that the intense status rivalry between schools in that period, it must have incensed the boys at Eton to have their thunder stolen by an obscure Midlands establishment, which had only recently become a public school. They considered their own to be the leading school in all respects. By placing an absolute taboo on the use of hands in their version of football, and decreeing that goals could only be scored below the height of the goal sticks, they were, one can suggest, attempting to assert their leadership of public schools and put the upstart rugbyans in their place.
So really, they're just fighting snobism with snobism, and that's why you can't touch the ball in association football.
Okay, well...
Because again, that was not really a rule. Like, there were prohibitions on carrying. Mm-hmm. There were different rules around, like, catching or just knocking a ball out of the air. But nobody really... Mm-hmm. It was not a trend to be like, you cannot touch the ball with your hands. This is a pretty, like, clear emergence from this, well, we have to be special.
Also... Not the last time one of these schools will have to develop more explicit rules about touching.
Those upstart rugbyans, for what it's worth, were working just as hard to give that snobby energy right back. Again, from Adrian Harvey's history, quote, rugby's printed code was not designed for outsiders and certainly was not an attempt to disseminate their game. Indeed, there is no evidence that rugby made any attempt to publicize its football. Rugby was one of the last of the major schools to start submitting reports of their football to the press, end quote. As one of their submissions to Bell's Life in London, which was a weekly broadsheet that covered sports, as one of their submissions read, quote, having often seen football matches at Eton in your paper, allow me to send you one from the football school, rugby, end quote. Yeah, it's not the first nor last time somebody is going to go like, well, obviously this is the true football.
I do like the sort of clannishness, though, behind, like, having your own set of rules and, like, not in the sense of, like, oh, when everyone plays this game, it's because of our influence. More just like, no, this is literally ours. You cannot play it. You can't even know what we're doing in here.
Yeah, like, there was not a real interest in disseminating the game. It just kind of disseminated because people liked it.
Mm-hmm.
So just to summarize the timeline where we're at here, 1845, rugby formalizes their first set of rules. This is followed by Eton in 1847, and over the course of 1850s, other schools are following suit. Students moving on to universities often were effectively limited to playing football with students from the schools they'd gone to, or at least ones with sufficiently similar codes. A lot of participants and observers alike were increasingly calling for a unified set of rules, and as early as 1846, there is evidence of alumni representing multiple schools, Eton and rugby among them, meeting at Cambridge to try and work out a common code. Various iterations of these Cambridge rules emerged over the next 17 years, with the 1856 version being the oldest one that survived long enough to be studied later. In these, we see a compromise between the increasingly divergent Eton and Rugby forms, with provisions for catching but not carrying. By 1863, concessions to the rugby camp were mostly, although not entirely, gone. Most auspiciously, we have the following restriction, quote, "The ball, when in play, may be stopped by any part of the body, but may not be held or hit by the hands, arms, or shoulders," end quote. By the early 1860s, these forms of football were by no means limited to elite educational institutions, and so the same problem was manifesting among regular schools, military colleges, army bases, and private clubs. Two of the most prominent examples studied by Adrian Harvey in his book are a pair of London area teams that were formed from mixed groups of former public school players, one called the Crusaders and one called Dingley Dell. I mention these only because I could not have invented a better caricature of the two types of English energy you can have. The phrase Dingley Dell and the Crusaders, it sounds like an acid rock band that just like briefly made a splash in the same region, like what is that, like 100 right. years later? Yeah. It's like, yeah, nobody, like, you can't find any of Dingley Dell and the Crusaders records anymore, but their performances were like so influential on Mick Jagger, he like completely, you know, like.
This is a small tangent, but it does remind me of in the baseball playoffs, the Detroit Tigers have a player named Dylan Dingler.
Hell yeah.
I just think that's beautiful to like look at a newborn baby and be like, I'm going to name it Dylan Dingler.
Yeah. Like you have to, if your name is Dingler, you have to name your son like Jonathan or something. Like, do people forget what their last name is when they name their kids? I don't know.
I think so.
At last, in the fall of 1863, the Football Association would be formed. This is an entire story into itself that we cannot fully get into, but the FA's initial drafts for a unifying rule set still held a lot of concessions to the rugby style of play. After a lot of meetings and questionable maneuverings, though, by November 24th, the delegates had largely adopted the Cambridge rules we're just talking about, which the recent ones had only been published a month before. And this is again to the chagrin of the pro-rugby camp. And this doesn't necessarily mean delegates who are representing rugby school, but just like delegates representing clubs and schools that just were fully on side of the rugby way of playing. Mm-hmm. During a meeting on the 8th of December, the delegates who had supported rugby style rules walked out of the meeting, and that was that. It's compressing a lot, but like people have gone over the minutes of the meetings and being like, they were basically trying to railroad the rugby people out of voting and shit. Mm-hmm. It's an enormously complicated thing. People can read up on their own, but it is like I say, questionable maneuverings, at least. Mm. And fortunately, or unfortunately, depending how you feel about non-association football, the toothpaste is completely out of the tube here. The hardline course that's taken by the FA had hurt their standing, and association football didn't meaningfully surpass rugby football in popularity for many years. I couldn't get a great answer. It's kind of debatable as to when exactly this happened, depending on like how you're measuring it. But the takeaway being, there was no immediate clear favorite of like what is going to be the dominant football code. But it was becoming obvious that the two competing models were here to stay, so this is going to cause some problems that would require clever solutions. On that note, while it was Cambridge University that turned out to be so formative in the history of the FA's rules, Oxford University was going to have a very different sort of impact. To help illustrate why, here is a humorous quip published in the satirical magazine Punch back in 1895.
"It is inevitable if you converse with a young Oxonian of immature intellect that he will murder the Queen's, or as he would call it, Quagga's English, by some expression as, 'What a beastly sense-sagger!' or invite you to stagger for the dagger, i.e. stay for the day. But competent authorities are inclined to think that this laborious form of undergraduate wit, or wagger, is doomed to speedy extigger."
Now, I've long been steadfast in this belief, but like 19-year-old boys are the most destructive force in human history. They should not be allowed to have any impact on anything. And like, lest you think this is an exaggeration, this came paired with a long list of actual Oxford slang terms. They're not making this up.
This is like those old lists for AOL Instant Messenger for parents. Like, oh, what is your child messaging about?
Yeah, is your child messaging about wagger, pagger, bagger? I'm not even going to read what that translates to. I want people in the comments, you know, on YouTube, on Patreon, whatever, write in what you think a wagger pagger bagger is a Oxford slang for.
Having been both a child and an adult in life, I can definitely see why this would be so much fun, and I can definitely see why this would be so infuriating.
Yeah, it's entirely just to annoy adults, I'm pretty sure. The goddamn youths. Now, for anyone who's not...
Toggers sounds like a word you're not allowed to say anymore.
Yeah.
Most of these do.
Yeah, I think the double G...
I think the double GR probably does
double
it, yeah.
G-E-R is just... Yeah. It's got a real unfortunate punch
yeah.
to it.
Yeah, that gives me the same feeling as like when there was that like brief span of days on Twitter when people were using the term clanker to refer to AI or like robots. And like it very, very quickly got uncomfortable with like how much people were using it and what they were saying with it. So.
Now, for anyone who has not pieced together why that's relevant, the Encyclopedia Britannica is going to explain the rest. Quote. The game played under the Football Association's rules thus became known as Association Football. Inevitably, the names would be shortened. Linguistically creative students at the University of Oxford in the 1880s distinguished between the sports of rugger, rugby football, and asoker, association football. The latter term was further shortened to soccer, sometimes spelled soccer, S-O-C-K-E-R, and the name quickly spread beyond the campus. However, soccer never became much more than a nickname in Great Britain. By the 20th century, rugby football was more commonly called rugby, while association football had earned the right to be known as just plain football. Now, were you aware of that's where the term soccer comes from?
From association football? Yeah.
Okay, I don't think I pieced it together. Like, I think I was aware of the term rugger. This was before I started writing this, but this was maybe like 6 months ago. I'm like talking to people in Europe and I'm like, what does the word soccer come from anyway? And I was like, a soccer. Oh my God, fuck you.
I think I knew that just when I was getting into soccer as an insecure American. I do remember looking up, like, why is it called soccer? And seeing, like, oh, this name that, like, British people make fun of us for. It's like, from Britain. Like, it's like, has its origins there. So it's their fault, really.
It's from their fancy boys. Like, what more do you want from me here?
Yeah. So that is one of those things that I very quickly was like, oh, yeah, so this is one reason I should feel okay about calling it soccer.
Yeah, I mean, it's a useful distinction. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it took a while to convince all the groups playing broadly association-style games to join the FA and adopt their strict rules, and this recruitment process included extending an invitation to rugby school itself in 1867. While they did decline, their representative acknowledged that a unified code for rugby-style games was lacking and even suggested that the FA might be interested in governing this as well. And there's two ways you can interpret that. They might have meant that this one organization will just oversee two codes because we're never going to reconcile them. Or they were hinting at maybe we can still reconcile because that is more plausible than you might expect. And part of the reason that the two camps were not that far apart is that carrying the ball was just one of kind of two major sticking points that the FA, like the rest of the FA had with the rugby rules. The other was a practice called hacking. Have you heard of this?
Probably not in this context.
Yeah, the players kept trying to get into the mainframe. It was called hacking, or alternatively, shinning, if that paints a better picture.
Okay, that I think I can maybe figure this out, but
yeah,
that's a bit more clear.
A lot of the sources really kind of breeze over what hacking even is. And so I was thinking like, well, like shinning, does it mean actually hitting someone's with your shins? Like maybe shin-to-shin contact? And after reading more and more, I'm like, okay, no, I think it's literally just kicking people in the shins, like just institutionalized in the rules. And the funny thing is that hacking and tripping, which has also been part of certain rule sets, they both fell out of vogue relatively quickly. When the Rugby Football Union formed in 1871 and they published their inaugural code as a governing body, they abolished hacking and tripping.
Hmm.
So one of the main sticking points was done away with regardless. Now, hacking had its vociferous defenders, including F.W. Campbell, who's one of the major rugby-aligned delegates in the original FA meetings. He was representing, I think, I didn't write it down, it's called Blackheath, I believe. I don't know if it was a club or a school. So he's not from rugby school, but he is like one of the main people pushing for the rugby-style game in these FA meetings. And he's kind of a 19th century rugby Don Cherry.
Being so angry that I can't kick someone in the shins that I wonder if it's like even worth it to play this game at all.
Literally, yes. So he argued, quote, hacking is the true football game, end quote. And further, quote, It savors of those who like their pipes and grog or schnapps more than the manly game of football, end quote. He believed that abolishing the practice would leave the game emasculated, his word, when he opined that you people who opposed hacking probably didn't even go to public school. He had the following exchange with the inaugural FA president, A.C. Pember. And let's just have a quick look at A.C. Pember here. They just don't make mustaches like this anymore.
Oh, that's a big one.
Yeah.
Hello, listener, and welcome to the Midreel ad. If you enjoy Canuck is a Slur, a podcast about Canadian culture, and you want to hear more of it more often, there is an option. The Canuck is a Slur Patreon. Signing up at any tier gets you access to Give Kelly Your Money. And joining an elevated tier gets you access to monthly bonus episodes. If that sounds good, you can sign up at www.patreon.com/Canuck is a Slur. And now, back to the episode.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, lessons learned.
Yeah, learning a lot of lessons about One Albania Internet, possibly.
You're on our turf, and you're going to play the ball game our way. I do just want to say, because everything went to shit on the last slide with the mustache, and I did just want to say, the mustache, that is a good one. That is, you could, like, get a good grip on this guy's face just from his mustache and
yeah.
Do whatever you wanted to do with him at that point.
Yeah, he takes the concept of handlebar mustache seriously.
Yeah, like, it's not supposed to actually function as a handlebar.
Says you. So in this slide, you will be the FA president, A.C. Pember, and I will be this representative, F.W. Campbell.
Perhaps you'll allow me to say that I took down 15 the other day to play a match, and I was the only one who had not been at a public school, and we were all dead against hacking.
Be that as it may, sir, I think that if you do away with it, you will do away with all the courage and pluck of the game, and I will be bound to bring over a lot of Frenchmen who would beat you with a week's practice.
Classic trope of saying, like, oh, you don't want to play this, like, rougher version of the game. Like, what are you, like, more of a pansy than the Frenchmen? The French are always the sounding board here.
Very much so. Instead of, I don't know, turning the frickin' frog's gate, it's like, they're turning the frickin' game French. Like, that's that is the line of sissification.
They're turning the game frogs.
Ah, yeah.
Ah.
Even as early as 1860, you can find an example of an old rugbyan lamenting that the game had gone too soft. This particular man's impassioned screed is too long for us to go through, but it sets the tone with the line, quote, "Fellows did not care a fig for the ball then, except inasmuch as it gave them a decent pretext for hacking," end quote. He later waxes on.
"And then there was Hookie Walker, the swell hack on the sixth side. My eye, didn't he walk into the school? Only shut up 10 fellows for the season, and sent half a dozen home for the rest of the half. Merely to see him come through a scrummage was the signal for all the ladies to shriek and faint. Bless you, my dear fellow, they enjoy looking on at a scrummage of all things now. More shame to us."
He later concludes,
"But, dash my buttons! You haven't a chance of getting a decent fall in the present day. And no wonder, either when you see young dandies, got up regardless of expense, mincing across big side and looking just as if their delicate frames wouldn't survive any violent contact with the ball. Hang the young puppies! We shall all have fellows playing in dress boots and lavender-colored kid gloves before long. My maxim is hack the ball on when you see it near you, and when you don't, why then, hack the fellow next to you."
Incredible stuff.
The kids are woke and gay now, because they're taking some basic precautions that by our standards would still seem pretty barbaric.
They're taking all the hacking out of the game now. Might as well be ballet without the hacking. I'm telling you, there used to be an honor code. If a guy was getting up to stuff, you just hack him and be done with it. Okay, I got time? Yeah, I don't know. That's my 1860s rugby Don Cherry.
What has happened to the game I love?
Oh, I used to play a game with a hooky walker. Oh, we'll put her there. What a guy. Swell guy. Oh, he knew how to hack him, boy. Okay, didn't he walk into the school? Ronnie boy. Anyway. Alas, rugby school's bare-bones 1845 guidelines underwent at least one major overhaul in 1862, and the 1871 codification was a big step in getting the game on course. But as we now know, they too would not be able to stop their game from splintering. None of this is to say that there was even as clear of a delineation between the two camps as you might think. Coming out of those meetings in 1863, the FA's rules were still quite a ways away from the ones that make up their game today. For example, in their first version, players were still entitled to a fair catch followed by a free kick. At the same time, just because the FA had built off the Cambridge rules didn't mean that Cambridge stopped using their own rules. As we covered earlier, their last version of these rules from the same year, players were allowed to stop the ball with their hands and arms, but not catch it. All the while, schools and clubs on either side of the divide were still cross-pollinating, often playing by hybrid rules. A few examples provided by one of our sources include rugby-style games that incorporated Eton-style bullies and or rouges, a minimal handling kicking game that still allowed touchdowns, a game called rugby that forbid carrying and had players kick through Harrow-style uprights with no crossbar, and a team based in Edmonton mentioned, that is described as, quote, a mix of Harrow, Eton, and rugby rules, end quote. Codification, going great. Also, another piece of trivia, as a Canadian Edmonton boy who goes, ooh, Edmonton, England has been mentioned, do you know who unsuccessfully contested the parliamentary seat in Edmonton?
Edmonton, Canada?
No. The English parliamentary seat of Edmonton.
I don't know. I didn't know if you guys had parliamentary seats there, too.
I mean, we do, but that...
See, Edmonton, like, recently?
No, this was, I think, in, like, the 50s. Should be a big hint.
Oh, Oswald Mosley.
It's our boy Ross McWhirter.
Oh.
But that's really real. That's a really tenuous connection. Certain groups, rather than compromise or commit either way, just played both varieties of the game at different times. The Rugby Football Club in Hull, that would later join the upstart Rugby Football Union in its first year, and still later go on to become a founding rugby league club during the schism, which it still is today, they regularly played association games against clubs in the FA.
Mm.
And better yet, one of the RFU's founding members, the Clapham Rovers, won the FA Cup in 1880. Football association, going great.
I like that there's some that are double dipping here in both of these leagues, because it does remind me of, in kind of the late 1800s with baseball, when you have cricket starting to fall out of fashion and being supplanted by baseball, you still have some people who want to play both. And it's like there is that sort of like tribe mentality where you have so many people who are just cricket people, so many people who are just baseball people. And then you have like four guys who are like, well, I like both. I like playing both. It's kind of like, did you ever watch the Disney original movie Brink?
No.
A big part of it is the rivalry between skateboarders and skaters. That's a plot point. In real life, it's like, okay, most of the people I know who do one of these do both of them. So
between which two camps?
In the movie, it's roller skaters, like extreme like trick skaters.
Okay.
And skateboarders. I know quite a few people who do both of these things. So it's like the standoffishness in the movie is quite funny.
It does make sense when you think about it, like, especially when these games aren't that fall apart. It's just like, well, are we carrying the ball today? Are we kicking each other in the shins today?
Mm-hmm.
Is nowhere near as different as it is, you know, in 2025.
Mm-hmm.
To make matters even cloudier, there was also the emergence of something called the Sheffield Rules at this time. This was one club that published some basic rules in 1858 and an updated version in 1862 that they swore they'd only play by. Other regional clubs around them, they just fall into line with these Sheffield rules, so it kind of makes this arguably a de facto code. It begets a formal Sheffield Football Association in 1867, and this operates concurrently with the existing football association for a decade before they shipped over and they adopt the FA's rules. So they kind of just wither away as a distinct governing body after that. And the Sheffield FA is interesting in that it produced its own tournament the year it was formally established, beating the FA to that mark by 4 years. So, like, this is the first football tournament is put on by these other people, the Sheffield FA. A lot has been written about the impact that this collective had on the culture of the game. Tony Collins, a history professor we're going to pay closer attention to later on, he's very critical in his book of the narrative that Sheffield had much impact on the lasting rules in the long run. He kind of compares it to myth-making, just like the Webb Ellis story.
Mm-hmm.
And the Doubleday myth, for that matter. He talks about all of it. Our focus in the series is much more on the evolution of the gameplay itself, and there's little to suggest to me that this branch has much of a substance to contribute to our story, so it will just get that brief mention. If nothing else, it helps drive the point home that in the 1860s and 70s, even with more written and published rules, there was still very little consensus on what was fun to play, fun to watch, or even just proper sporting. there's a period of time where I guess you don't have three. You have two governing bodies and then one completely separate sport that desperately needs a governing body. And all of them are basically calling it football and kind of treating themselves as the proper one. There's a little more to it. Like, there's a lot to say that the Sheffield FA was very supportive of the FA and like trying to keep them afloat when they were floundering. But it's a thing that's very much of interest to association football nerds, but it's just not relevant enough to our story. By the time the 1860s rolled around, as you may know, British colonialism had been going on for quite some time. This whole assortment of ball games had long since been exported to the colonies and had plenty of time to undergo their own journeys, shaped by the material and social conditions in each locale, and sometimes shaped by the games that were being played there. We've certainly fallen into the trap of talking about England a lot, but it should be stressed again that I don't think you could name a place where people weren't engaged in ball play of their own before the British or other Europeans got there. Depending where we're talking about, those indigenous games would influence the settler sports in turn. On that note, let's turn to a man named Tom Wills. Have you heard of Tom Wills?
I don't think so.
Probably not. He's a fascinating individual. We could easily spend a whole episode on him. Virtually everything we're going to say about him is sourced directly from one biography by a writer named Greg DeMore, a professor, not of history, but interestingly of psychiatry, who more or less looked at a subject's life and asked, why hasn't anyone covered this properly? And so, thanks to Mr. DeMore, here we go. And I've compressed a lot here, but Tom Wills was born in 1835 in the penal colony of New South Wales. His paternal grandfather was an English highwayman sentenced to death for robbery, but this was commuted to life in Australia, with his wife and daughter coming with him. Grandpa arrived in 1799, had his sentence further commuted to a conditional pardon 4 years later, and finally received a full pardon in 1810. He then became a successful merchant, then died anyway at the ripe old age of 32, with their sixth child, Tom's father Horatio, still unborn. Tom's grandmother remarried a different convicted English robber who had founded Australia's first newspaper, although both of them died roughly a decade later. For what it's worth, Tom's father didn't seem to inherit much as a younger sibling, not a good sign for raising a fancy boy, to say nothing of Tom's maternal grandparents, who were also convicts. The biography I read didn't specify their crimes, just that they were Irish, although, well, for all we know, that might have been all they were guilty
probably
of.
Probably enough. Yeah. That's probably going to do it around that time. I guess, though, I mean, like, saying, like, oh, like, his such and such were convicts. I guess the dating pool is probably pretty restrictive if you're not looking for a convict to partner up with in Australia at this time.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, that is one of the most Australian origin stories you can have. It's so fascinating that something it's like, yeah, you are going to, you get a death sentence and they're like, well, okay, we'll commute you so you can do some hard labor. That's fine. And then this just gets commuted over and over until it's like, once you're in Australia, it's like, well, you are white, so we could really use you. It does not take that long to go from a death sentence to be like, hey, you're a rich guy now. You've got like an estate or whatever.
Now I'm like the king of New South Wales. Like,
yeah, it's the upward mobility at the expense of the indigenous people is just incredible.
A tried and true process, I would say, living in the United States.
Oh, it's just like, it is such a stark example of laws are just vibes. We don't really have to deal out justice to you. We'll just get you out of the country. And then it's like, all right, now you can just, it's going to prisons to conscript for your military. It's like, we don't actually give a shit as long as you're willing to go do stuff for our imperial needs.
If I can plug a long ago Beyond the Breakers series, it was originally a bonus series. I think we released them all on Main. We did like a 3-part series on prison hulks. And how they were used in the British Empire. So we talked a lot about Australia. We talked a bit about Ireland, and we talked about their use in the American Revolution as well. So that was a good long ago one that we should probably revisit at some point. It could probably use an update.
I think it was a while ago because I've listened to all the main feed episodes for some time, and I don't think I've heard that one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Tom's father became a homesteader in the colony of Victoria and got all caught up committing atrocities against indigenous people, but he wanted better things for his eldest child. Tom got sent to the city to live with his rich uncle. His uncle was the firstborn of his dad's generation. And then he shipped off to England to live with his rich aunt, who'd married a doctor and then a merchant in London.
Okay.
So it's like, yeah, you're generationally going from like your grandpa was banned from the country forever to skirt a death sentence to like now you get to live in like fancy boy houses in London. In late 1850, Tom started attending a quaint little public school in Warwickshire, as his father attempted to assuage the boy's homesickness by shipping him, among other things, a pair of local black swans. Both of them died in transit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Shipping someone the live swans and having them die reminds me of one of our episodes where we talked about, I think it was a seaplane, actually, with canaries back in the day when they were a more exotic type thing and people would ship those back home. And they would ship them in, you know, like cases of like 100 canaries. And my question was like, why would anyone want 100 canaries? And a very helpful listener commented and saying, well, you wouldn't. You would want maybe like 10, but, you know, in transit, that's probably what you're going to end up with.
Yeah, that does sound familiar. Tom became a top flight athlete, particularly as a cricketer, rising to become the captain of the school's team. He was a highly motivated, overtly talented young man with incredible potential and a clear passion. And so naturally, his father wrote to him at length about how his grades weren't good enough and his handwriting sucked and he'd better fucking come back to Australia as a lawyer. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but...
That's great.
He graduated in 1855, having made a name for himself as a cricketer to the extent of receiving national media attention, spending more than a year playing the game all over the country, this being the UK, as his dad tried to pull strings to get him into Cambridge University. This doesn't materialize, although he does manage to play as something sounding suspiciously like a ringer in a single inter-university match, helping Cambridge to a big win over Oxford. And like, this is, gets conflated and people are like, yeah, he went to Cambridge. See, he played in this game. And then the guy looked closer. It's like, no, he played a game for Cambridge and was never enrolled. So really, I think they just picked up a really good cricketer to be like, yeah, you're on our team today. It's like when the Simpsons episode, when they're
haven't seen it.
In the end, he boards a ship back for Melbourne in 1856 as his family is tired of him burning through their money, his father having worked his way up to becoming a member of the legislature. So his dad gets like some money, but I guess not fuck you money. Tom's reputation precedes him and he's expected by locals, this is back in Melbourne, to partake in cricket matches on arrival, which he does, becoming a massive star practically overnight. He is so good that people are said to have complained of him playing in fixtures because it was unfair to weaker teams.
That's got to feel good. That probably feels really good.
Back then, everyone just sucked. It was not sporting to be talented.
Yeah, everyone's got to be like kind of the same level of shitty. It's like the same reason that like watching college baseball is entertaining. There's like four guys who are really, really good.
Yeah. There's a really good old like Onion article that was like, in my day, ball players were for shit. Now, Tom was, it must be maintained, a fancy boy. He was in cricket's upper caste, the amateurs, that is people who could afford to play cricket for free. And yeah, so this kind of is going to echo some of the stuff we see in rugby, which is like the reason amateurs and professionals is such a sticking point. It's a little different from like what you see with like the NCAA stuff today. Mm-hmm. The issue is that like being a professional is like, well, you're a common person. You're a working person.
The parallel I could draw there with baseball is this team like the Cincinnati Reds. Very historic team, and they're typically like described as the first professional baseball team. I believe it's because they were the first to field a full team of all professionals. Like professionalism had existed before that, but they had that piece of history, and now it's sort of looked back on as this founding moment, this historic shining moment of the game. Whereas like at the time, that wasn't necessarily a good thing. That was kind of used as a disparaging remark about you have to be paid to play this game that we all love.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Again, the parallels are incredible. It's happening in every sport at this time, essentially. So yeah, he's an amateur cricketer, but over the course of his life, he was more than happy to support and encourage the play of people that would have been positioned as his social inferiors, namely Indigenous people, women, professional players.
The Irish.
Yeah. People more Irish than him. Later in his career, he even went as far as the completely unprecedented move of captaining a cricket team composed of Indigenous players. In short, this man was obsessed with cricket. He lived and breathed cricket, and the worst part of his year was having to go months without cricket during the winter, which I'm putting in sarcasm quotes for Canadian reasons.
I'm feeling that now with the end of baseball season coming soon. Although the Brewers did win their series.
Hell yeah.
They pulled it out last night in game 5. So there's a bit more Brewers baseball to come, but still I am feeling that same sort of like onset of melancholy knowing that it's going to be months without it.
You see, a lot of people would be looking forward to the possibility of winning, but
No, no. Doesn't matter how it ends. It means there's no baseball.
Do the leagues work in such a way that the Brewers can face the Blue Jays in the World Series?
Yes, they could.
Oh, okay. Well, then we can have a big schism on our Discord over it.
That'd be a lot of fun, yeah. Actually.
Right. So, yeah, he wants, he hates that you can't play cricket during the winter, or that you don't play cricket during the winter. He doesn't want his teammates to go soft. He wants cricketers to stay active with a dedicated winter sport. So, yeah, it's very funny to think of it when the Association of the Cricketers by, well, you can't be wusses, you're cricketers. I know, cricket is very athletic, don't write in. Yeah, so he wants them to stay active with a dedicated winter off-season sport for the cricketers. He gathered with three compatriots in 1859 to hash out a series of rules based on some of the various games that they were able to draw from, with Tom Wills leaning particularly hard on the practices of the institution he'd studied at, rugby school. Out of this meeting, or likely series of meetings, the rules of the Melbourne Football Club were laid out, which quickly begat the only slightly altered Victorian football rules that 10 Melbourne clubs signed off on together in May of 1860, forming the basis of the code that we know today as Australian Rules Football.
Okay. Yeah, Australian Rules Football is one of those where, like, I would place my knowledge of, like, rugby rules at, like, I don't know, 60 to 70%. Australian rules football is probably down to like 30 or 40. When it's on television, for whatever reason, it kind of takes me like 10 minutes to readjust of like, okay, how is this different from rugby? What can they do? What can't they do? Why does the field look like that?
Yeah, so it's just a very interesting left turn for this guy, that he is a through and through cricketer. And again, it's not that he is solely responsible, but he is one of the people most responsible for this code emerging.
Mm-hmm.
While the Victorian Football Association wouldn't be officially founded as a proper governing body until 1877, these clubs still collaborated to define a shared set of rules that they published and distributed, arguably making this the first proper football code to ever emerge, depending on how you want to define things. Yeah, so they have this set of rules that people are agreeing to 3 years before the FA, I think 2 years before the Sheffield FA, and, you know, long before any, like, people have agreed on a core set of rugby union rules.
Just out of curiosity, so the FA that you're referring to there, is that one continuous, like, organization to the FA that exists today?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, so when they form as the Football Association in 1863, that is what I'm referring to every time I shorten it to FA. And, I believe they are completely continuous since then. So, like, they were off to a really, really rocky start, but now they are like very ubiquitous, at least in the UK. Yeah. And I mean, it's a little bit like, obviously this set of rules didn't emerge first. They're completely pulling from experiences on the existing games we've talked about. And in his case, the rugby school rules particularly, but it is just kind of funny that the people that actually really hammered out consistent rules first were in Australia. So if you want to be not even a pedant, because I don't even know if it's correct, just a very annoying person. But the next time somebody snobs at you about, like, football, or what you call soccer is the real football, be like, yeah, I don't know. I think these people are just ripping off Australian rules.
Mm-hmm. It is kind of ironic that Australia, a country that many of us associate with lawlessness, is the first to really codify a set of rules here.
In a way, yeah. So over time, Tom gets a lot of rugby's rules into the Australian game, including the controversial oval ball, which he championed aggressively, and not everyone was on board with. People are like, this ball sucks. Like, I don't want, it's not good for what we want to do.
First of all, it's not a ball. That's not what a ball is.
Yeah. Oh, it's an egg. Now, one aspect that was omitted and that none of these framers wanted was hacking. Hacking is out. They do not want shin kicking.
Get it out. Get that
stupid shit
out.
Yeah. Now, his story is going to take more turns. Less than 2 years later, Tom Wills' father de facto retired him from cricket by taking him on an expedition to Queensland to organize a new homestead. While Tom and a few others were on a week-long run into the nearest settlement for supplies, Dad and the other settlers were massacred by the people whose unceded territory they were intruding on in the largest ever mass killing ever committed against Australian settlers.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Turnover on downs.
Yeah. A real three and out or two and out of settlement. Because he's going into town for supplies, it's like, you know, you're a wide receiver and you're running your route and you turn back and the quarterback's been sacked to death and you're like, shit, I ran my route so well, though.
The entire offensive line has been literally massacred. I was recently reading It's just called Escravido, Slavery by Laurentino Gomez. And he does write about, you know, amongst the horrors of the slave trade, obviously. You do have little bright moments where, like, on the coast of Africa, you know, a slaving party is ambushed and completely massacred by locals. So that happens there, too.
Yeah, like, I extremely don't feel bad for these settlers. They really fucked around and found out, so.
Yeah.
Despite this, Tom actually stays on at the homestead that they were building to build it up regardless. And he doesn't play another game of cricket until 1863. So that was, I think, a full two or three years he goes without playing cricket.
Oh, man, he was probably fiending for it.
Well, he eventually fully returns to the game, which includes his captaincy of the Aboriginal cricket team from 1866 to 67. So it's a really, like, he is such a land of contrast because in the wake of his family being killed, understandably, like, he's writing to his friends about, like, oh, yeah, like, to hell with these people and, like, writing shitty things. But, like, there's an anecdote from this author at the beginning of the book where he's like, I uncovered all these little things where in 1867, he just, like, his, like, mother wants him to come over for lunch. So he just brings the entire Aboriginal cricket team to, like, sit down in his mother's house and have dinner.
It is kind of funny because it's one of those things where you could be like, oh, that's funny. Like, how is it that, you know, Aboriginal people killed your family and yet you get along with them so well? And then he actually, like, outwokes you. He turns around, he says, well, actually, there are a diverse range of people and languages. So that's how.
Yeah, I think you can't get into the head of somebody who was existing that long ago. Like, there's quite, you could speculate that, like, he is making a differentiation between the group that lives.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is, I don't know how far up in Queensland it is, but it's like, certainly at this time, you are a completely different group of people from who is down there in what is now Melbourne. Yeah, it's like if you're, I don't know, if your family was murdered by Dutch people, you would probably be fine hanging out in Spain. But just like what you get out of his journals is just like, it's not clear, but certainly an interesting guy living a very interesting life. Yeah, so then this team actually goes on to tour England without him. That's like a whole other story. And then he has a tumultuous career as he descends into alcoholism, probably fueled by PTSD. And he met his end in 1880 at the age of 44 by stabbing himself thrice in the heart with a pair of scissors at his home in full view of his wife and a servant while on the lam from the hospital, where he was being treated for delirium fueled by alcohol withdrawal.
Yeah, I guess that would get you maybe in the right mind state to be able to do that. That is a hardcore way to do it.
Yeah, that is compressing the entire second half of this book into two sentences. Like, it is, there is so much going on in this story.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that is like stories you see about the occasional suffering from CTE, you know, from American football. Yikes.
Interestingly, both William Webb Ellis, the guy who we pretend invented rugby football, and Tom Wills, the guy who is actually pretty massively responsible for Australian football, were both accused of being cheaters at cricket in their respective times. Now, one of the ongoing debates in the history of Australian football is to what extent its development was influenced by the game of Marngrook, a term literally meaning ball game in the Woiwurrung language, variations of which were being played by a variety of Australian Aboriginal peoples, but predominantly in the general area of today's state of Victoria around where Melbourne was settled. Tom Wills actually befriended Indigenous locals as a child and learned to speak a local dialect, but the exact nature of the influence on the football code that emerged is not a question you and I are equipped to solve today. However, I do think it's a good reminder that regardless, people were already kicking and catching balls long before outsiders got there with a new game. I really, if people are interested, I would really encourage them to read Tony Collins' book in particular, because he compares all these myths, like the Doubleday myth and the William Webb Ellis myth and all these other things. He does a lot of critiques on the angle of, like, the connections between sport and empire and colonization. And, like, I'm quite certain he is a very much a straight up Marxist. So he loves to talk about the material conditions and shit. And I acknowledge that some of this information is very tangential, but I hope it illustrates the main theme of this series, which is that none of this development is strictly linear. A linear narrative, however, suits the governing body's purposes as far as identifying themselves as the arbiters of sport. The Fédération Internationale de Football Association, better known as simply FIFA, and note the confusing acronym where Federation here is the actual name of the body and Association is the name of the sport. They used to have a really cool history section on their website, which is unfortunately now only accessible through the Wayback Machine on the Internet Archive. But they trace their lineage to the ancient Chinese game of Suju, I believe it's pronounced, which is literally kickball. Mm-hmm. This dates to around the 2nd or 3rd centuries BCE, but they, as in FIFA, also acknowledge that what they call football has, quote, a long and intricately branched ancestral tree, end quote. Whether you can make an unbroken causal connection from Tsuju to association football is a question I'm not sure you could ever answer, but an intricately branched tree exists regardless. There is an entire other constellation of Asian games related to Tsuju that we cannot get into, save to say that one of its current descendants, Sepak Takraw, is one of the world's most popular team sports not of an identifiably European origin. In this game, players are using everything but their hands and arms to get the ball over the net in a manner reminiscent of volleyball, and yet again, I cannot stress enough how badly everyone needs to go to check out highlight reels of this shit. It fucking rules. There was a clip where somebody, like, basically put the ball over the net, like, with their junk or with their, like, thigh. Nuts.
Just the Wikipedia, the main picture on the Wikipedia page is ridiculous. Like, it's so cool.
Of Sepak Takraw?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Similarly, whether association football can meaningfully point to games like the Greek Episkyros or the Roman Harpastum in its genealogy, as the FIFA website also tried to do, is also not really answerable. But given that the evidence points to games involving throwing, carrying, tackling, or grappling, and ultimately getting the ball over a line, it shows how dense this web of sports has been over the years. I think that a really intriguing piece of circumstantial evidence suggesting that the map of cross-pollination was really quite expansive for a very long time comes in the form of one of the more identifiable folk sports that came up in all this research, and that's the game of Leiloburti from Georgia, all the way over in the South Caucasus. In a familiar trend of oversimplification, this game is frequently analogized to rugby football, which, probably not by sheer coincidence, has grown a significant following in the country. But from everything we've talked about so far, the original game of Leiloburti has an uncanny resemblance to the medieval mob football that was practiced in Britain and the nearby areas of Western Europe.
I'm looking at the picture. I'm on the Leiloburti Wikipedia. I see a picture of the ball. Looks like a pumpkin.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very pumpkin-esque.
Yeah. Oh, there's a really good video of, like, there's like one village that is still playing this game. And there's, it's been a while since I watched it, but I think it was like an English rugby player of some sort went to go to this place in Georgia and to, like, try to participate in it. Very cool video.
Mm-hmm. There used to be a show called Dahani Tackles the Globe, featuring Dahani Jones, a former linebacker from the NFL. And the premise of the show was he would go around the world and play these different, like, local sports. A very cool show. He would do, like, some of the big ones. Like, he went to England and tried out rugby. But then he would travel to other places and play some of these less widely known sports. Very cool concept.
Yeah, I would love to see more of that. So to quickly work in that earlier question of why was mob football called football at all? I'd also like to add that for all the versions we know of this chaotic holiday ball wrestling activity, it only appears to have strong ties to the word football in English.
Mm.
The Welsh word cnapan appears to derive from a term for knob, lump, or round piece, while the Irish cad and the French soule or shule have uncertain and kind of very old etymologies, but there's nothing to suggest they even refer to foot in any way.
Mm.
As for Georgian, Leiloburti essentially means field ball. There was an attempt to codify Leiloburti in the Soviet era, although from a cursory look, it doesn't seem like that version has gained a lot of traction. The folk game has persisted, as I was saying, in a single village in independent Georgia, and in the face of a more internationally connected sporting world, rugby union, like I said, has grown a great deal there. As we finally move on to the Americas here, I think there's cause for reflection on how something like standardization in sports relates to things like colonization, imperialism, capitalism, and globalization. Recalling the claim that England was the cradle of sport, I hope I presented enough evidence to support the following argument. I don't agree with that assertion, but I think it becomes a bit more accurate if you say that England was the cradle of codification, with that having both good and bad aspects. There's an obvious logic to sporting codes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you're talking about safety standards, being able to easily play against other groups. But with that being said, I am kind of left wondering, well, what's lost with the disappearance of folk games?
Mm-hmm.
It's not unlike the feeling I get, especially recently traveling internationally. Is it very convenient and practical for me personally that more and more people all over the world speak English? Yes. But, like, what are the more hidden consequences of things like that?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was just talking to somebody who mentioned on Discord, they're like, oh yeah, my grandparents, like, spoke Alsatian, like, you know, in, like, the kind of Germanic language in the Alsace region. Yeah.
Yeah, like, Alsace-ish. I think they call it in German.
Oh, sure, yeah. But he's like, nobody young does anymore, right? Like, you kind of have this erosion of these little micro-cultural things.
Yeah, I mean, like, I know that's a big problem in places like India, where you have such huge language diversity. But then India, you also kind of have the double colonization of not just English, but also Hindi sort of being implemented as a more national language, even though it itself started as one of these local languages. And it sort of just got bigged up by the British as being this sort of national language. So it's like you have a double layer of language colonization.
Mm-hmm. So that was a lot of words and dates and concepts thrown at you, but that is quite enough for part three, I think. And thankfully, none of those kinds of themes we're talking about there are going to come into play regarding the future of football, which we'll get into in part four. And yes, I swear to God, Canada will be mentioned. Yeah. How do you feel about all that? I know I there was a bit of a monologue at the end. So do you have anything you want to add?
I was just thinking with Lalo Berti being this, rough, full contact ball game. I imagine this is the kind of thing that a young Joseph Stalin probably enjoyed.
Possibly. Didn't come across it. Well, that's all I have for part three. So do you want to quickly plug your show before we get out of here?
Sure. I am Tanner. I am from a podcast called Beyond the Breakers. That is a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. We look at shipwrecks, but more importantly, we look at the wider historical context that led to the shipwreck, what came after the shipwreck, the people involved in bringing this shipwreck about. We're far more interested in the history than the technical nuts and bolts of everything. So give us a listen. We are in season 5. We've got a pretty diverse range of topics that we've covered. So there's probably something that will catch your interest.
Hell yeah. And if this series has caught your interest and you're enjoying the content of episodes like this one, please consider supporting the show on Patreon. Being able to potentially make an income off this show would allow me to keep doing it full time. You can find our various tiers on patreon.com/Canuck as a slur. We have tiers as low as $2 USD. And if you pay at the $5 tier, you can get access to our wonderful secret bonus content that is, I'm going to say, 3 times as good as anything you've heard. So if you like this, boy, are you going to love 3 times the quality.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I understand these days we are in a cost of living crisis. Money is tight. So as always, if you do not have the money for Patreon, you can do other things. You can pull your money out of the guest Patreon and you can put it into ours.
can redirect a little bit of that Kelly's way.
Mm-hmm. Pull your money out of all of our guest Patreons, past, present, and future, and put them into mine.
Pull your money out of your 401k. I mean, you're not doing anything with it right now. So
the 401k is not going to exist in the future. It's all going to collapse, but you can have bonus episodes now.
Yeah. I mean, don't pay your taxes.
Don't pay your taxes. My God. Think of this is nonviolent resistance. The tax
man do you have any idea what the U.S. does with that money?
Yeah. And that's why you shouldn't pay your taxes in any country. Look, insert the name of your country here. Do you know what they are doing with that money? They're not paying me, I'll tell you that much. Patreon will pay 8% of it, 92% of it to me. Also, if you did sign up for our Patreon on iOS, you are paying 30% extra to the Apple Corporation. So pull your money out of our Patreon and subscribe on a desktop computer, literally anywhere but on your iPhone, because you are getting ripped off. And if you are considering joining anyone's Patreon, do not do it on an iPhone. You are getting squeezed
mm-hmm.
by Tim Apple.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That was entirely, entirely too long of an episode. So until next time, hang the young puppies. Canuck is a Slur is an independent collaborative effort to present a critical, progressive perspective on Canadian history and culture.
Drop them.
To make consistent, high-quality content, we need your support.
Let's tangle.
Head on over to patreon.com/Canuck as a Slur to sign up.
Beauty.
If you're still on the fence, well, here's the sales pitch. Patrons at the good old Canadian boy level unlock expanded access to our Discord server, including sneak peeks at upcoming episodes.
Let's go!
Patrons at the good old Ontario boy level will also get into our archive of bonus content, which includes an extra episode every month. Patrons at the good old Kingston boy level get to commission a free piece of bad art every month as well, in addition to further special Discord privileges.
Oh, how she loves the Stanley Cup. Hockey man is what I am. Let's go! Listen to what I say. Play that game the Canadian way. Hockey man is what I am. Let's go!
We'd love for you to come and follow us on our various socials, which you can find linked in the episode description. You can also see any further links for our guests and co-hosts there as well. The creators of this work would like to acknowledge the Indigenous peoples across the continent that had their homes stolen, land broken up by arbitrary borders, cultures suppressed, languages banned, children kidnapped, and who were subjected to many other forms of colonial violence. We also acknowledge the many treaties broken and still unceded territories across Turtle Island. Thanks for listening, eat the rich, and happy trails to you.
But given that the evidence points to games involving throwing, carrying, tackling, or grappling.
Grappling.
Yeah.